Unit 4, page 93. Production and distribution. The Unit 4 has been divided into two parts, Part A and Part B, for the better clarity and understanding. 4.1 Objectives. 4.2 Production Meaning. 4.3 Production Function Meaning, which is subdivided into 4.3.1 Short Run Production Function and 4.3.2 Long Run Production Function. 4.4 Production Function with one variable on input, which is subdivided into 4.4.1 Law of Variable Proportion and 4.4.2 Significance of Law of Variable Proportion. 4.5 Production Function with two variable inputs, that is subdivided into 4.5.1 Isoquant Meaning and Introduction, 4.5.2 Schedule Showing Isoquant, 4.5.3 Marginal Rate of Technical Substitution, 4.5.4 Isoquant Map, 4.5.5 Properties of Isoquant Curves, 4.5.6 Isocost Curve, 4.5.7 Producers Equilibrium. 4.6 Long Run Production Function, which is divided into again 4.6.1 Loss of Returns to Sale, 4.6.2 Increasing Returns to Sale, 4.6.3 Constant Returns to Sale, and 4.6.4 Diminishing Returns to Scale. 4.7 Economics to Scale, which is again divided into 4.7.1 Internal Economics to Sale, 4.7.2 External Economics to Sale, and 4.7.3 Diseconomics to Sale. Unit 4, Part B, Distribution. 4.8 Distribution, Meaning and Introduction, which is again divided into 4.8.1 Nature Factor Market, 4.8.2 Marginal Productivity Theory of Distribution, 4.8.3 Physical Productivity, 4.8.4 Revenue Productivity. 4.9 is Rent, which is again subdivided into 4.9.1 Demand and Supply Theory, 4.9.2 Transfer Earnings, 4.9.3 Quasi Rent, page 94. 4.10 Wages, which is again subdivided into 4.10.1 Subsistence Theory of Wages, 4.10.2 Collective Bargaining Theory of Wages, 4.10.3 Differential Rate of Wages, 4.10.4 Minimum Wages. 4.11 Interest, Meaning and Concepts, which is subdivided into 4.11.1 Net and Gross Interest, 4.11.2 Classical Theory of Interest, 4.11.3 Neoclassical Theory, Loanable Funds Theory, 4.11.4 Liquidity Preference Theory. 4.12 Profit, Meaning and Concepts, subdivided into 4.12.1 Gross and Net Profit, 4.12.2 Uncertainty Theory of Profit, 4.12.3 Innovation Theory of Profit. Page 95. Production and Distribution. 4.1 Objectives. After starting this unit, you will be able to 1. Understand the meaning of production and production function. 2. Appreciate the relationship between input and output. 3. Analyze the loss of production with 1, 2 and all variable inputs. 4. Differentiate between average product and marginal product. 5. Understand the technique of internal and external economics to scale. 6. Understand the meaning of factor prices, rent, wages, interest and profit. 7. Analyze different loss of factors of production. With the above objectives, we proceed with Unit 4, Part A. 4.2 Production. Let us know the meaning of production and production function. Production is one of the most important activities in the circle of economic activities. The main objective of production is to satisfy the demand for commodities and services of the community. The term production is a very broad concept. The term production means transformation of physical inputs into physical outputs. Production uses four factors: land, labor, capital, and organization. Inputs also other items like raw materials of all kinds, power, services like transport and communication, warehousing, banking, shipping, and insurance. Outputs are goods and services, what we get at the end of productive process which the firm sells. In short, outputs refers to finished products. According to J.R. Hicks, production means any activity, whether physical or mental, which satisfies the wants of other people through exchange. Production always results in either creation of new utilities or addition of values. Production is undertaken by production. Production analysis is always made in physical terms. 4.3. Production function. The entire theory of production centers around the concept of production function. Production function is defined as a functional relationship between physical inputs, factors of production, and physical outputs, that is, the quantity of goods produced. It expresses the technological or engineering relationship between quantity of physical inputs and physical outputs of a firm. It is also called as input-output relation. Page 96. In algebraic terms, the production function may be written as Q is equal to F in brackets A, B, C, D, T, ... N, closer brackets, where Q is equal to physical quantity of output per unit of time. F is equal to functional relationship. A, B, C, D, ... N is equal to quantities of various inputs, and T is equal to prevailing state of technology. Factors inputs are of two types. 1. Fixed factors. Fixed factors remain constant and will not change with level of output. Example: land, buildings, machines, tools, equipments, etc. 2. Variable factors. Its quantity varies with variations in the level of outputs of production. Example: raw materials, power, transport, and communication. The distinction between two types of factors inputs will hold good only in the short run. In the long run, all the factor inputs will become variable in nature. 4.3.1. Types of production function. This classification is based on the time element. 1. Short run production function. 2. Long run production function. The functional relationship between changes in inputs and consequent changes in outputs depends on the time element. This time element considered here in the functional or operational time period. 4.3.2. Short run production function. Short run production is a situation where only variable factors can be changed and fixed factors remain constant. The firm size, technology, etc. is constant. The sign at the top is used to denote fixed factors. Technology is held constant. Q is equal to F in brackets L, LA, K, O, T, close the brackets. In the short run, we come across two kinds of production function. 1. Quantities of all inputs, both fixed and variable, will be constant and only one variable input will be varied. For example, the law of variable proportions. 2. Quantities of all factor inputs are kept constant and only two variable factors inputs are varied. For example, isoquants and iso cost curves. Page 97. 4.3.3. Long run production function. The term long run is defined as a period of time long enough to permit variations in the inputs of all factors of production. In other words, the long period is such a time period over which all factors become variable. Thus, there is no distinction between fixed and variable factors in the long run, as all factors become variable factors. Q is equal to F in brackets L, LA, K, O, T, closer brackets. Hence, all factor inputs are denoted as variable components. In this case, the producer will vary the quantities of all factor inputs in the same proportion. Example, the law of returns to scale. 4.4, production function. One variable input case. 4.4.1, the law of variable proportions. This law is one of the most fundamental laws of production. The law of variable production, or the law of non-proportional output, will explain how variation is in only one factor input brings variation in output. Under this law, it is assumed that only one variable factor production is variable while other factors are fixed. As we increase the quantity of variable factor while keeping other factors constant, the output may increase more than proportionately in the initial stages of production, but finally it will not increase proportionately, rather the returns will be less than proportionate. The law can be stated thus: as the quantity of different units of only one factor input is increased to a given quantity of fixed factors, the total average and the marginal output decreases in different proportions. In the words of Professor Benham, as the production of one factor in a combination of factors increased after a point, first the marginal and then the average product of that factor will diminish. Assumptions. Only one factor unit is to be varied while all other factors should be kept constant. 2. Different units of a variable factor homogeneous. 3. The scale of output production plant or the size and efficiency of the firm remains constant. 4. The technique of production does not change. 5. The law will hold good only for a short and given period. Illustrate. To illustrate the working of this law, let us take a hypothetical production schedule of a firm as given in the table below. Page 98. It is assumed that the amount of fixed factors, land and capital is given and held constant throughout. To this, the labor, the variable factors added unit-wise in order to increase the production of commodity, X. The state of technology remains constant. The input-output relationship is thus observed in the table given below. Here we've got a table which gives us the input and the output relationship. The first, when the units of the variable inputs is zero, the total output is zero, average product is zero, and the marginal product is zero. When the units of variable input is 1, total output is 20, average product is 20, and the marginal product is zero. When the units of variable input is 2, total output is 50, average product is 25, and the marginal product is 30. When the units of variable input is 3, the total output is 90, average product is 30, and the marginal product is 40. This is stage 1. In stage 2, when the units of variable input is 4, total output is 120, average product is 30, and the marginal product is also 30. When the units of variable input is 5, total output is 135, average product is 27, and the marginal product is 15. When the units of variables is 6, total output is 144, average product is 24, and the marginal product is 9. When the units of variables input is 7, total output is 147, average product is 21, and the marginal product is 3. When the units of variable input is 8, total output is 148, average product is 18.5, and the marginal product is 1. This is of stage 2. In stage 3, we got units of variables is 9, total output is 148, average product is 16.4, and the marginal product is 0. When units of variables input is 10, total output is 145, average product is 14.5, and the marginal product is minus 3. This is of stage 3. By reading the above table, we may observe the following interesting points. 1. The law of diminishing returns becomes evident in the marginal product column. Initially, the marginal product of the variable input rises. The total product rises at an increasing rate. Average product also rises. This is analytically described as the stages of increasing returns, stage 1. 2. After a certain point, when fourth unit of labor is employed, the marginal product slows down. However, the average profit continues to rise. This is the stage of decreasing returns, that is stage 2. 3. When the average profit becomes maximum, the marginal product is equal to the average product. In table, when the fourth unit of labor is employed, the average product is 30 and the marginal product is also 30. 4. Finally, a stage is reached when the marginal product is reduced to 0 and becomes negative thereafter. This is the stage of negative returns, that is stage 3. 5. When the marginal product becomes 0, the total product is maximum. When the marginal product becomes negative, the total product begins to decline in the same proportion. However, average product is decreasing at this stage, but it remains positive up to a certain point. These points would be more explicit when the given production schedule is plotted graphically. Below we got a graph which illustrates the same. Page 99. In the diagram, the x-axis measures the units of a variable factor, labor, and the y-axis measures the output. The total product curve TP shows similar information about the behavior of the total output is in the production schedule in the table. The total product curve has an upward slope up to point B and then it moves downwards. However, the slope of TP curve changes at each point. The curve becomes steeper up to point A. After this, TP curve slopes becomes negative. Evidently, TP moves through stages. 1. The first stage of increase in the rate of total output. 2. The second stage of increase in the rate of the total output. 3. The third stage of decline in the total output. The three stages are basically confined to the behavior of the marginal product. The MP is rising, diminishing, and eventually it becomes negative. Hence, the MP curve has an upside-down U-shape. When the MP curve intercepts at point N on the axis, it corresponds to the point B on the TP curve, which signifies that when MP is equal to 0, TP is a maximum. Again, the declining part of the TP curve is in proportion to the negative part of the MP curves. Similarly, the AP curve is also inverted U-shaped curve. It also signifies the operation of the law of diminishing returns. The AP curve starts sloping downward after it reaches its peak at the end of stage 1. The MP intersects at the AP at its maximum point because at this point only MP is equal to AP. Thus, in the beginning, the MP curve starts sloping downwards, yet it remains above the AP curve because MP is greater than AP. Page 100. It thus intersects the AP curve at its peak point from above. After the point of intersection, both AP and MP are declining, but MP is lesser than AP. Therefore, the MP curve now lies between the AP curve. Explanation of the stages. The law of increasing returns, stage 1. The first stage is called as the law of increasing terms on account of the following reasons. In this stage, the total product is increasing at increasing rate. Average and marginal product also increases. But at this stage, there is scope for effective use of fixed factors and so the total product will increase further. Since all the products are increasing, this stage is called increasing stage. The law of diminishing returns, stage 2. In the short run, the firm seeks to increase output by employing more and more units of variable factors, thereby trying to substitute fixed factors by variable factors. In this stage, TP is increasing at a decreasing rate. The MP and AP will be equal and later both diminishes and MP becomes 0 at the end of this stage. At a point where MP becomes 0, TP reaches maximum. Since MP diminishes at this stage is called decreasing stage. The law of negative returns, stage 3. When the input of a variable factor is much excessive in relation to the fixed factor, is much excessive in relation to the fixed components in the production function, negative return stage occurs. Negative return stage comes. For example, an excessive use of chemical fertilizers on a farm may eventually spoil the farm output. In this stage, TP decreases for the first time. At this point, MP becomes negative. So the producer, instead of getting profit, will undergo loss if he operates at this stage. Stage of operation. Stage 3 of negative returns is irrational stage, and the producer will be under loss if he operates in this stage. Similarly, stage 1 is also irrational because at this stage there is more scope for the producer to increase his profit, and the TP is also not maximum at this stage. Stage 2 is the only rational stage of production in the short run. It is an area of operation in which the firm can maximize its profits because at this stage, TP is maximum and MP is zero. Page 101. 4.4.2. Significance of the law. 1. It is useful to businessmen in the short-run production planning at the micro level. A careful producer planning at micro level. A careful producer will not move into the third stage of negative returns. Rationally, the ideal combination of the factors proportion will be taken when the average product is at its maximum and it is the minimum cost combination of factors. 2. The law implies that when under the given technology, the stage of diminishing returns takes place, we should change the technology to avoid its occurrence. Thus, the law gives guidance that by making continuous improvements in science and technology, the producer can postpone the occurrence of diminishing returns. 4.5. Production function with two variable inputs. The important concern of firms is to work out the cheapest or the lower cost method to produce a given output of several alternative methods open to it. There are a large number of combinations of factor inputs which can produce a given output, and the producer has to select the most economical combinations out of them. 4.5.1. Isoquant. The term isoquant has been derived from the iso meaning equal and the quant meaning quantity. Hence, isoquants are also called as equal product curve or product indifference curve or constant product curve. Isoquant curve represents all the different combinations of two factors inputs yielding the same level of output. 4.5.2. Isoquant schedule. An isoquant schedule shows the different combinations of two factors inputs, namely labor and capital, which produce a same level of output. Below we got a table which illustrates the same. In this, the first column is a combination. Second column is a factor input, that is labor. Third column is factor input capital. Fourth column is total outputs in units. And MRTS, which means marginal rate of technical substitutions. When the combination is A, the factor input labor is 12. The factor input capital is 1. Total outputs in units is 100 and MRTS is nil. When the combination is B, the factor input of labor is 12, factor input capital is 2, total outputs in units is 100 and MRTS is 4:1. In combination C, the factor input labor is 5, the factor input capital is 3, total outputs in units is 100, MRTS is 3:1. In combination D, factor input labor is 3, factor input capital is 4, total outputs in units is 100, and the MRTS is 2:1. In combination E, factor input labor is 2, factor input capital is 5, total outputs in units is 100, and MRTS is 1:1. In the schedule, all the 5 factors combination will produce the equal level of output, that is 100 units. Hence, the producer is indifferent with respect to any one of the combinations mentioned above. Page 102. Here we got a diagram in which if we join the points A, B, C, D, E, we get an ISO equal to quant curve IQ. This curve represents 100 units of output that may be produced by the employing any one of the combination of two factors of inputs. 4.5.3. Marginal rate of technical substitutions, MRTS. The producers substitute on input in the place of other in the production process. The substitution of one input for another without changing the level of output is called as marginal rate of technical substitutions. The slope of the marginal rate of technical substitutions in terms of inputs of capital K and the labor L is MRTS is equal to K divided by L. In the isoquant schedule, we can notice that in the second combination, the producer is substituting 4 units of labor for 1 unit of capital. Hence, in this case, MRTS of capital for the labor is equal to 4:1. MRTS will be diminishing. In the schedule, we can observe that as the quantity of the capital is increasing relatively to the quantity of labor, the number of units of labor that will be required to be replaced by 1 unit of capital will diminish quantity of output remaining the same. 4.5.4 Isoquant MAP. A set of isoquant curves having different combinations of inputs with different levels of output is called as isoquant MAP or equal product MAP. In other words, a number of isoquants representing different amounts of outputs are known as isoquant maps. Page 103. Here we got a diagram, and in the map, IQ1 and IQ2 and IQ3 are different isoquant curves giving 3 different levels of output, that is 100, 200 and 300 units respectively. 4.5.5 Properties of isoquant. 1. Isoquant slopes downwards from left to right. 2. Isoquant is convex to origin. 3. Isoquant does not intercept either axis. 4. An isoquant curve line to the right represents high output and an isoquant line to the left represents a lower output. 5. Isoquant need not be parallel to each other. 4.5.6 Isocost line or curve. The concept of isocost line is similar to the budget line or price line of the consumer. The management has to buy many kinds of labor, raw materials, machinery, etc. In order to buy them, the manager is expected to know the price of the input. The manager wants to minimize the cost of any outputs he produces. So, it is required to draw an isocost curve. An isocost curve is a curve or a line representing equal cost. It indicates the combination of 2 inputs which the firm can purchase at given prices with a given outlay. It shows 2 things, 1. Price of 2 inputs and 2. Outlay of the firm. Example, suppose the producer has priced 10,000 for the purchase of 2 inputs, labor and capital. Suppose further the price of the 2 factors are priced rupees 1,000 per unit of capital and 2,000 per unit of labor. The firm will have 3 alternative possibilities before it. They are 1. To spend the whole amount of money only on capital and secure 10 units of it. 2. To spend the whole amount only on labor and secure 50 units of it. 3. To spend the amount partially on capital and partly on labor. Line AB shows maximum possibilities of labor and capital available to the firm, which cannot choose any combination beyond this line, nor will it choose any combination below this line. AB is known as the factor price line or the cost outlay line or the isocost line. Page 104. The slope of AB shows the price ratio of capital and labor, that is 1:5. Thus, this line represents the different combination of labor and capital which can be purchased with rupees 10,000. Below we got a diagram which illustrates the same. The isocost line will shift to the right to producers, increases its outlay from rupees 10,000 to rupees 15,000 on the contrary. If he reduces the outlay to rupees 5,000, there will be a backward shift in the position of isocost line. 4.5.7 Producers equilibrium. Equilibrium of the firm, optimum factor combination, least cost combination. A producer of a firm is said to be in equilibrium when it is able to produce more or the highest output with the given outlay and given factors of inputs. or rational producer may attain equilibrium either by maximizing an output of a given cost or minimizing cost subject to a given level of output. In order to determine the producer's equilibrium, we should integrate an isoquant map with an isocost line. The intention of the producer is to maximize the profits. This would become possible when he produces optimum output at the lower cost of production. Hence, the producer selects the least cost combination of the factors of production. The following diagram explains how the producer reaches the position of equilibrium. Page 105. In the diagram, isoquant curves IQ1, IQ2 and IQ3 represents outputs of 1000 units, 2000 units and 3000 units respectively. AB is the isocost curve, is tangent to isoquant IQ2, representing 2000 units of output. Point T indicates the maximum amount of capital and labor which the firm will combine to produce 2000 units of output. Isoquant IQ3 falls outside the isocost line AB and it cannot be chosen by the firm. On the other hand, isoquant IQ1 will not be preferred by the firm, even though between R and S are not suitable because outputs can be increased without increasing additional cost by the selection of a more appropriate input combination. Therefore, point T is an ideal combination which maximizes output. It is a point at which the firm is in equilibrium. The point of tangency tells us that at that point, the slope of the factor price line IB and the slope of the isoquant IQ2 are equal. The slope of the factor price line reflects the ratio of prices of the two factors, namely capital and labor. The slope of the isoquant reflects the MRTS. Thus, MRTS is equal to P1 by P2. Limitations of the principle of least combination. The factors may not be perfectly divisible. In that case, effective substitutions may not be possible. It is very difficult to calculate the marginal product of each factor. The producer has to decide not only the best proportion of factors, but also the best scale of production. Hence, this least cost principle cannot perfectly be worked out in practice. 4.6 Long run production function. 4.6.1 Loss of returns to scale. Adjustment among different factors can be brought about in the long period. Thus, all factors become variable in the long run. That means, in the long run, the size of a firm can be expanded as the scale of production is enhanced. Economists use the phrase returns to scale to describe the output behavior in the long run in relation to the variations of the factor inputs. Expansion or increase in the scale of production means that all factor inputs are increased in the same proportion. In returns to scale, all the necessary factors inputs are increased or decreased to the same extent so that whatever the scene of production, the proportion among the factors remains the same. Page 106. We may state the principle of returns to scale as follows. As a firm, in the long run, increases the quantities of all factors employed, other things being equal, the output may rise initially at a more rapid rate than the rate of increase in inputs. Then, output may increase in the same proportion of increase in input, and ultimately, output increase less than proportionally. When the quantity of all factors inputs are increased in a given proportion, and the output also increases more than proportionately, then the returns to scale are said to be increasing. When the output increases in the same proportion, then returns to scale are said to be constant. When the output increases less than proportionally, then the returns to scale are said to be diminishing. Thus, there are three phases of returns to scale in the long run. 1. The law of increasing returns to scale. 2. The law of constant returns to scale. And 3. The law of diminishing returns to scale. Here we've got a table which illustrates the same. Increasing returns to scale 1, when the scale of inputs is 1 labor plus 3 acres of land, the total product is 2 and the marginal product is also 2. When we have 2 labors plus 5 acres of land, total product is 5, marginal product is 3. When there are 3 laborers plus 7 acres of land, total product is 9 and marginal product is 4. When we have 4 laborers plus 9 acres of land, total product is 14 and the marginal product is 5. In the case of constant returns to scale 2, when there are 5 laborers plus 11 acres of land, total product is 19, marginal product is 5. When there are 6 laborers plus 13 acres of land, total product is 24 and marginal product is 5. In the case of diminishing returns to scale 3, when there are 7 laborers plus 15 acres of land, total product is 28, marginal product is 4. When there are 8 laborers plus 17 acres of land, total product is 31 and marginal product is 3. When there are 9 laborers plus 19 acres of land, total product is 33 and marginal product is 2. Page 107. At the scale of 1 labor plus 3 acres of land, the total product is 2 quintals. To increase the output, the scale is doubled, the total product increases to more than double. That is, returns to scale are increased. If the scale of production is further increased, the marginal product remains constant up to a certain point and beyond it, it starts diminishing. This is shown in the diagram below. In the diagram, it is clear that the marginal returns curve slope upwards from A to B, indicating increasing returns to scale. The curve is horizontal from B to C, indicating constant returns to scale, and from C to D, the curve slopes downwards from left to right, indicating the operation of diminishing returns to scale. 4.6.2. Increasing returns to scale. Increasing returns to scale means that output increase in a greater proportion than the increase in inputs. Example, if all the inputs are increased by 25%, the output increase is by 40%, then the increasing returns to scale is prevailing. Algebraically, output triangle Q by Q is equal to triangle F by F. Triangle Q by Q is equal to proportional change, and triangle F by F is equal to proportional change in a factor output. 4.6.3. Constant returns to scale. If the scale of inputs are increased in a given proportion and the output increases in the same proportion, for example, if all inputs are increased by 25%, the output also increases by 25%. In mathematics, the case of constant returns to scale is called linear and homogeneous production function, a homogeneous production function of the first degree. Page 108. 4.6.4. Diminishing returns to scale. Diminishing returns to scale is operating when output increases less than proportionately when compared the quantity of input uses. For example, if all inputs are increased by 25%, the output increases only by 20%. 4.7. Economics to scale. The study of economics to scale is a study of advantage of large-scale production. Large-scale production is beneficial and economical in nature. The advantages or benefits that accrue to a firm as a result of increase in its scale of production are called economics to scale. According to Professor Marshall, these economics are of two types, viz. Internal economics and external economics. Let us study both in detail. 4.7.1. Internal economics. Internal economics are those economics which arise within the firm because of the actions of an individual firm to minimize its cost. These advantages rise to one firm due to the increased division of labor and complete utilization of inputs. Classification of internal economics. 1. Economics of superior technique. When the size of firm is big, it becomes possible to employ bigger and better types of machinery. The improved techniques gives place to specialized production. This also reduces the cost and time. For example, cultivating the land with a tractor instead of using wooden plows and bullock carts, or use of computers instead of human labor, etc. Economics of increased dimensions. The big firm avoids wastage of time and reduces the expenditure, and this also will reduce the cost of production. For example, operating in double-decker bus instead of two separate buses. Economics of linked process. A large firm can undertake various processes of production from the raw material stage to the final finished product stage and even the distribution stage. For example, Last textile mill having its own spinning units, weaving units, dyeing and colouring units, etc. This saves the expenses of intermediaries and thereby reduces unit cost of production. Page 109. Economics of research and byproducts. A large firm can invest more funds on research and it can also make uses of its wastages as byproducts in the most economical way. For example, a sugar factory can use its pulp, molasses for the production of paper, distilleries, etc. Economics of power. Technical economics also include power economics. In the large firm, machineries keep running continuously and so there is no wastage of power and it brings about economics of power. 2. Labor economics. The large firm will have the scope to introduce division of labor and specialization, and with this it can also use modern machineries and technology which improves efficiency of labor. With this, good quality products can be produced with the minimum expenditure. 3. Marketing economics. The large firm undergoes advantage while selling the products and also while buying the raw materials. The advantages are called marketing economics. The large scale firms enjoy the privilege of getting discounts when they buy raw materials in bulk. They also have strong bargaining power, saving in transportation charges, advertisement expenditure, can face competition effectively, etc. So these firms enjoy the advantage of marketing. 4. Financial economics. Large-scale industries can arrange for the funds very easily. These firms will get financial assistance from banks and financial institutions in reasonable interest rates. They can also consolidate funds from public through public deposits, shares, debentures, because these large firms will be able to gain the confidence of the public easily. 5. Risk-bearing economics. Large-scale firms can bear the risk effectively. They produce variety of goods in the firms and so will be able to face the risk and uncertainties. They can face these uncertainties in the following ways. 1. Diversify the production. 2. Extend the market. 3. Diversifying the production process and source of supply. And 4. Facing the competition effectively. 6. Economics of research. Large firms hold more resources than the small firms. It can have its own research unit with the experienced researchers and the scientists in the field. With this, it can find out new ways of production, invent of new machineries, and there is scope for better innovations. Page 110. 7. Economics of welfare. Each firm should provide better facilities to the laborers and should always try to strive for their welfare. The laborers will feel satisfied and work more efficiently and will try to contribute more towards the development of the firm. Large-scale production units definitely have more resources to spend on the welfare schemes of its laborers than the small units. 4.7.2. External economics. External economics are those economics which accrue to the group of firms or the whole industry as a result of the expansion in the output. This is not due to the efforts of one firm or industry. It happens because of the localization of industry and any government policy, or even due to the progress in the industry or region. Classification of external economics. 1. Economics of concentration. When many firms are localized in one particular area, these are the advantages which arise from what is called as localization of industry. The benefits enjoyed by the industry are provision of better and cheap labor at reasonable rates, trained, educated and skilled labor, transport and communication, power, raw materials, marketing facilities, financial assistance to the private and public institutions, at cheaper interest rates, better use of byproducts, etc. 2. Economics of information. These economics arises as a result of getting quick, latest information from various sources. Since a large number of firms are located in a region, it becomes possible for them to exchange their views frequently. The common training camps, seminars, workshops helps in having discussions for any other improvisation. The publication of journals, magazines, newsletter, marketing information are readily available. This will help in developing contact between different firms. The interrelationship between different firms helps in economization of expenditure. 3. Economics of specialization. When the industry develops and extends itself, it can enjoy the economics of specialization, and this helps in production of better quality products more efficiently and at a much cheaper rates. Page 111. 4. Economics of welfare. Large-scale production units can provide more welfare schemes to its laborers. It can provide houses, education, training, insurance, medical facilities, entertainment provision, etc. The satisfied laborers involve themselves in the production activity, which increases production. 5. Economics of byproducts. Large industries can use its byproducts more efficiently without any wastage. This reduces the wastage of resources and also increases income to the industry. 4.7.3. Diseconomics of large-scale production. When the industry develops and extends extensively, after a certain extent, it has to undergo some diseconomics. These diseconomics may be 1. Difficulty in administrative management, 2. Lack of coordination, 3. Difficulty in decision-making, 4. Diseconomics of laborers, 5. Problem of risk and uncertainties, 6. Lack of factors of production, 7. Financial problems, and 8. Diseconomics of marketing facilities. Unit 4B. 4.8. Factor pricing. 4.8.1. Nature factor markets. Factor market is where factors of production are bought and sold. The theory of pricing deals with the determination of prices. It has two aspects, product pricing and factor pricing. Product pricing deals with the determination of prices of commodities, whereas factor pricing explains how the prices of the factor productions are determined in the market. The pricing of the factor input is based on subjective considerations. The demand for a factor input is derived demand, that is derived from the demand for the produce. It tells the product demand for inputs. So, there is joint demand for factor inputs. Demand for a factor input depends on its marginal productivity. Supply of a factor input depends on its availability. Thus, the price of the factor input is determined by two factors, demand for factor inputs and supply of factor inputs in the market. Page 112. Regarding the factor inputs, some of them are free gifts of nature, while a few others are man-made resources. Some of them are fixed in the supply, while few others are permanent. Some of them are mobile, while others are immobile. On account of these special features of factor resources, Marshallian theory of value cannot be applied to the determination of factor price. Hence, economists have developed a special theory called general theory of distribution to explain how the prices of the service of a factor inputs are determined in the market. The theory of factor pricing of distribution is the pricing of the productive resources. It studies how the factor production get the rewards of remuneration in the market. The theory of the distribution explains how land receives its rent, labor wages, capital interest, and organizer gets their profits. So, the theory of distribution deals with the distribution of national income among the various factors of production. The distribution of incomes may be either personal or functional. In personal distribution, we study how the personal income of different individuals are determined and how the inequalities of income rise among the different groups of people. Functional distribution deals with how the various factors of production are rewarded for their services. This is called pricing of factors of production. Marshallian theory of value cannot be applied to the determination of factor price. Hence, economists have developed a special theory called general theory of distribution to explain how the prices of the services of factor inputs are determined in the market. 4.8.2. Marginal productivity theory of distribution. General theory of distribution. David Ricardo and others first developed this concept, marginal productivity. According to this theory, a producer employs a factor input because of his productivity. The reward is prepared to pay for that factor's inputs depends on the productivity. There is a direct relationship between productivity and reward. Higher the productivity, higher would be the reward, and vice versa. So, a product would employ different units of a factor input up to the point at which the reward paid to the last unit of that factor input is equal to the contribution made by that factor input to the total production. A producer, while employing different factor inputs, is guided by the law of substitution. While working out the most ideal factor input combination, he substitutes one factor input to another till the marginal productivities are equalized. Thus, a producer would secure maximum profits when the marginal productivities of all the factor inputs are equalized. Page 113. Thus, MP of land, reward of land, is equal to MP of labor by reward of labor, that's equal to MP of capital, reward of capital, is equal to MP of organization, reward of organization. Productivity of factor input is of two types. One, physical productivity, and two, is revenue productivity. 4.8.3, physical productivity, refers to the amount of a commodity in terms of physical units which a factor input helps to produce. Example, a factor unit produces 10 units of a commodity X in a day. When physical productivity is expressed in terms of money, then we get the revenue productivity. For example, when a unit of X is sold at rupees 5, then the total revenue productivity would be 10 units into rupees 5, that is equal to rupees 50. Physical productivity is classified into two parts. One, average physical productivity, APP, and second, marginal physical productivity, MPP. APP is obtained by dividing total output by number of units of a factor input employed. For example, 50 by 5, that is equal to 10 units of a factor input. MPP refers to the increase in total output resulting from the employment of an additional unit of a factor input, keeping all other factor inputs constant. So, MPP is equal to change in total output by change in factors units employed, 4 by 1. 4.8.4, revenue productivity is also divided into two parts, ARP and MRP. ARP refers to the total revenue output produced by a factor unit divided by the total number of units of that factor employed. Example, ARP is equal to total revenue by number of units of factor input employed. MRP of a factor unit is the net addition to the total revenue made by the employment of an additional unit of a factor input, assuming the quantity of all the other factor inputs are kept constant. Page 114. MPP is equal to change in TR by change in units of factor input employed. So, according to the theory, the rewards to the factor inputs should be equal to MRP and ARP. So, rewards is equal to MRP is equal to ARP. Below is a diagram which illustrates the same. Where in the diagram, OQ is equal to the number of units of the factor input employed, OR is equal to long run reward of a factor input, at P reward is equal to MRP is equal to ARP. Assumptions. 1. Perfect competition in both product and factor markets. 2. It assumes full employment. 3. Inputs are perfectly divisible. 4. Homogeneous units. 5. Factor units are perfectly mobile. 6. Productivity is the cause and reward is the result. 7. Supply of factor inputs remains the same. And 8. It assumes that reward paid to factor input are equal to its MP. Page 115. Criticisms. 1. The theory assumes perfect competition, but nowhere in the world markets are perfectly competitive. In reality, markets are imperfect. 2. It assumes full employment, but no accounting has reached the stage of full employment so far. 3. It is wrong to assume that all units of a factor input are homogeneous. In reality, no two workers are equal in the efficiency or productivity. 4. The perfect mobility of factor inputs is restricted by various factors like language, customs, habits, etc. 5. In reality, it is not possible to measure individual productivities. Production is a result of collective and joint efforts made by all factors inputs together. 6. One factor input cannot be substituted for another under many circumstances. 7. The theory neglects the technological improvements and its impact on productivity of factory inputs and corresponding rewards paid to them in the fast-changing economy. 8. The theory fails to explain the basis of rewarding the services of an entrepreneur. 9. The theory fails to analyze the impact of the powerful trade unions in the determination of rewards. In spite of several defects, the important contribution of this theory in factor pricing lies in showing the role of marginal productivity as an economic fail. 4.9. Rent. In economics, rent refers only to the income received from the ownership of land and other free gifts of nature. It is a reward for the services of land in the process of production. Marshall, the income derived from the ownership of the land and other free gifts of nature. Carver, rent is the price for the use of land. Page 116. 4.9.1. Ricardian theory of rent. According to Ricardo, rent is that portion of the produce of the earth which is paid to the landlord for the use of its original and indestructible powers of the soil. He explained the theory of rent with the help of an example. Suppose some people go to a new country and settle there. To begin, they will cultivate all the best lands available. There will be no need to pay any rent so long as such lands are available freely. Suppose another batch of people go and settle down in after some time. The demand for food will increase and so the demand for the agriculture produce will increase. And in the course of time, the first grade lands alone cannot produce all the food grains that are needed because of the operation of the law of diminishing returns. So, the second grade lands will be cultivated in order to meet the needs of the growing population. If the second grade lands are to be bought under the cultivation, the price of grain in the market will be equal to the cost of production in the second grade land. When the second grade land is cultivated, the first grade land will yield a surplus over the cost of production. This surplus is called the rent. But the second grade land will not yield any rent because the produce of the land will be equal to the cost of the production. The difference between the produce of grade 1 and grade 2 land is the rent of the grade 1 land. But suppose the demand for the food grains further increases, then the lands of the inferior fertility will be brought under cultivation. Then even the grade 2 land will yield rent and the rent of the grade 1 land will increase further. This inferior land is called grade 3 land and the produce cultivated in this land will be just equal to the cost of production. So, this land will not get any rent and this land is known as no rent land or marginal land. It has been stated that rent rises on account of differences in fertility of the land. The more fertile land will receive more rent as the demand for the food grain increases and the less fertile land yields less rent. Ricardo also believes that every country will have a marginal land. Assumptions. The Ricardian theory of rent is based on certain assumptions. 1. Rent is peculiar to land alone. Rent arises because of the inelastic supply of land and its difference in fertility. So, rent is a differential surplus. All the lands are not equal fertility. Only those lands which are more fertile than others will get rent. 2. Land has some original and indestructible powers. 3. Land is subject to the law of diminishing returns. 4. There is perfect competition. 5. The theory is based on long run. 6. The population keeps on increasing and as the population increases, the inferior land will be brought under cultivation. Page 117. Criticisms. Some critics have raised objection against the rent theory. 1. According to Ricardo, the best lands are cultivated first, but there is no historical proof for this. Best land may not always be cultivated first. Objection is raised on the phrase, original and indestructible powers of the soil. The fertility of land may decrease in the course of time by continuous cultivation. 3. Rent is not peculiar to land alone. Modern economists feel that rent may rise to any of the factors of production which is demand. 4. Ricardo has overemphasized the role of diminishing returns. This law will hold good only if the other factors, including the level of technology, are kept constant. But historically, Improvements in the agriculture have resulted in increasing returns per unit of labor in most of the advanced countries. 4.9.2 Demand and Supply Theory of Rent. Modern writers are of the opinion that basically rent arises on account of scarcity of land in relation to demand. Hence, it is called a scarcity rent. Rent is a price paid for the use of land when it is scarce in relation to demand for it. According to this theory, the price of land, that is, rent, is determined by the equality intersection per demand of land and supply of land, just like the price for a commodity. Demand for land. The demand for land is derived demand. It is derived from the demand for the products of land. If demand for the products of land rises, then the demand for land also rises. The demand curve slopes downwards from left to right as the demand for a factor input depends on its marginal revenue productivity. Supply of land. From the point of view of an individual, supply of land is unlimited elastic, but from the point of view of a society, its supply is fixed and as such it is perfectly inelastic. That is why if it is said that land has no supply price, then the supply curve of the land is a vertical straight line. If demand for land declines as shown by the demand curve D3, then rent becomes zero as land becomes a free commodity. Thus, the equality between demand and supply force determines the equilibrium rent in the market. It is to be noted that scarcity in relation to demand rent is paid for land. The products of land are scarce in relation to its demand. Page 118. 4.9.3 Transfer Earnings. Modern economists like Mrs. Joan Robinson, Samuelson, Benham Boulding, Stigler and others have developed the concept of transfer earnings to explain the determination of rent. According to them, rent is surplus over and above transfer earnings of a factor input. Transfer earnings is the minimum payment which is necessary to make a factor input to work in a particular occupation. When this minimum payment is not made for a factor input, it is quite natural that it will leave the existing job and shift elsewhere to another alternative job. So, it is the opportunity cost or income in a foregone alternative. The element of rent in the income of a factor input can be explained with the help of transfer earnings. If the payment of factor input is over and above, the transfer earnings are equal, then no rent would emerge. The below is a diagram which illustrates the demand and supply of land. 4.9.4 Quasi-rent. Professor Marshall explains quasi-rent as the income derived from machines and other appliances of production made by man. Quasi-rent will arise only for man-made appliances, the supply of which is fixed in the short run. According to Chapman, quasi-rent is the period of earnings of a factor input whose supply is fixed in the short run but is capable of being augmented in the long run. Such a factor must naturally be a man-made factor. Quasi-rent arises only in the short run. So, it is temporary unlike rent, which is permanent. The supply of man-made capital asset in the short run is fixed. That is, its supply is perfectly inelastic even though if its price goes up in the short period. It is not possible to increase its supply when demand for such capital assets rise in the short run. The supply being fixed, its price would go up. Marshall calls the additional income earned by these capital assets or factors inputs in the short run as quasi-rent. Page 119. DD is equal to demand curve. SS is equal to supply curve. OQ is equal to demand for and supply of land. At P, demand is equal to supply. OR is equal to equilibrium rent. OR1 is equal to new higher rent with a rise in demand for land. It is a temporary surplus. In the short run, transfer earnings of capital assets are zero. The entire earnings of capital assets are surplus over transfer earnings and hence they represent rent. In the short run, certain amount of maintenance costs are to be incurred to keep the capital assets in fit and working condition. So, quasi-rent can be described as the short run earnings of capital assets minus the cost of keeping them in running order. Quasi-rent is equal to total revenue minus TVC. In the long run, the short-run surplus disappears. adjustments can be made to changing demand. So, quasi rent is not there in the long. In the long run, TR is equal to TC, so no surplus. Below is a diagram wherein it represents the number of capital assets and the rent. SS is the perfectly inelastic supply curve. DD is the demand curve. Both meet at E, which is equal to the equilibrium point. OS is the supply of capital assets. OR is the equilibrium price. Supply remaining the same in the short run. Demand increase from DD to D2 D1. Page 120. Thus, the rent rises from OR to OR1. Since the number of capital assets are fixed, the transfer earnings are zero and the whole price is quasi rent. In the long run, the supply can be increased. So, the supply curve is perfectly elastic, RL. In the long run, supply arises from OS to OM. Consequently, rent falls to OR1, that is original one. In this case, there is no quasi rent. 4.10 Wages. Wages are remuneration paid to the factor of production labor for the services rendered by it in the process of production. Since the term labor refers to all kinds of workers, unskilled, skilled, or blue-collar and white-collar workers, as well as independent workers like teachers, medical practitioners, etc., the term wage also has a broad connotation. It includes pay, salary, fees, commission, bonus, etc., all kinds of income earned by labor as a factor of production. 4.10.1 Subsistence theory of wages. This theory is one of the traditional theory. This theory was given by one of the economists during physiocratic period, but later on was developed by Adam Smith. German economist Lassell called subsistence theory as an iron law of wages. This law gained prominence during 19th century. Karl Marx called this theory as exploitation theory. According to the subsistence theory of wages, the wages given to the labor will be just enough to maintain his family with basic necessities. It will be the minimum for the labor to only meet his basic needs and would not be able to meet any other wants of his family. If the wages is more than the subsistence, then the population tends to increase as laborers go for marriages, the supply of labor will increase, and when the supply of labor is greater than the demand for labor, then the wages will decrease to subsistence level. If the wages of the labor is less than subsistence, then the laborers do not go for large families, and the supply of labor will decrease, then the supply of labor will be less than demand for labor, and so the wages will increase to subsistence level. So, this theory popularizes that the wages should not be more the subsistence. The supply of labor is elastic in nature. It increases with increase in wages and decreases with decrease in wages. Criticisms. This theory has many criticisms. They are as follows. Page 121. 1. Not true. The population increase with increase in wages and the decreases with decrease with wages is far from truth, and there is no historical evidence to prove this. 2. No explanation for changes in rate of wages. We believe that the laborers accept the subsistence wages and it is same in all the jobs and industries, but various jobs and industries may have different wages, but is not explained in the theory. 3. Demand factors neglected. The theory gives importance only to the supply of labor, but the demand for laborers are neglected. 4. Long run theory. The theory considers only long period like change in population with changes in wages, but the short run factors are not at all considered in the theory. 5. Unclear concept. Subsistence wages concept is very unclear. When it is said subsistence, how much, how to decide, etc. is not clear. 4.10.2 Collective bargaining theory. Collective bargaining is one of the most important feature of industrial field. With the help of collective bargaining, the laborers will be able to raise their wages. This reduces the exploitation and increases their welfare. Collective bargaining is a contract between the employer and the laborer regarding the working conditions, wages and other facilities. The main objective of collective bargaining is not to fight with each other, but to discuss and come to an agreement between the two. Before, economists believed that collective bargaining has no role to play in deciding the wage rate, but in modern times, it has been realized that collective bargaining plays an important role in fixing up the wage rate. Wages are generally determined through negotiations between employers and trade unions representing workers. The employers, though wish to pay a low wage, are forced to pay a higher wage voluntarily because of the very presence of the trade unions. Trade unions are the associations formed by the laborers to increase their bargaining power. The trade unions can raise wages, Professor Samuelson, in a particular industry in many ways. 1. By reducing or restricting the supply of labor. 2. By using its collective bargaining power to revise standard wage rates directly. 3. By causing the demand for labor to increase. Page 122. 4. By resisting exploitation of workers at the hands of the monopolist's producer, that is, combating the monopoly power with countervailing power of the union. 5. By increasing the marginal productivity of laborers. 6. By increasing the demands of workers. It has to be noted that whenever the trade unions try to increase, they have to face difficult situations because if the wages are raised, the employment level cannot be increased, and if the employment level has to be raised, then the wage rates cannot be increased. So they have to sacrifice one for the other. Both cannot be done at the same time. Laborers try to increase the wage rates by bargaining collectively. The determination of wage rates with the help of the collective bargaining can be explained with the help of a diagram which is given below. In the diagram given, OX measures the employment level and OY axis measures the wages and productivity. In the diagram, ARP is the average revenue productivity curve and MRP is the marginal revenue productivity curve. IC1, IC2, IC3, IC4 are the indifferent curves showing the wage rates and the increasing satisfaction level of trade unions. As the wage rates goes on increasing, we can see that the gap between each IC curve is going on increasing. If the trade unions are given the choice to decide the wage rate, they would definitely choose a point where IC curve is equal to ARP. In the diagram, we can see that at point P, ARP is equal to IC3. At this point, OQ is the employment level and OW3 is equal to, in brackets, PQ is the wage rate. Any wage rate above the level of OW3 would cause loss to producer, and so he will fix the wage rate at OW3. Page 123. An important point to be noted here is the employer tries to fix the wage rate as low as possible and the trade union tries to fix it up as high as possible. So, ultimately, wage rate will be fixed at the point where ARP and IC are equal to one another. So, collective bargaining is a weapon through which wage rates are determined, satisfying both the employer and the works. 4.10.3 Different rates of wages. Labor market is different from commodity market. The price of labor is not the same. In other words, wage differentials exist in the labor market. The cost for differences are the following. 1. Derived demand. The demand for labor is derived from the demand for the product it helps to produce. The demand for various commodities is different, so the wages will be different. 2. Differences in the elasticity of supply. The elasticity of labor supply differs from person to person. At a higher wage rate, the laborers may work less and prefer more leisure. 3. Immobility of labor. Differences in remuneration is accounted to the vertical and horizontal immobility of labor. The labor which is highly mobile naturally commands higher remuneration. 4. Labor associations. Absence of trade unions will result in low wages. The employers are forced to pay high wages by the strong trade unions. 5. Differences in productivity. Skilled laborers are bound to receive higher wages than the unskilled laborers. So, differences in efficiency are also responsible for wage differences. 6. Seasonality. In the time of a season, the demand for certain types of labor will increase, so the wages will group wage rate will come down during off season. 7. Customs and traditions. Inheritance, environment, training, sex, etc. create non-competing groups in the country. 8. Government policies. The wage policy of the government may also lead to differences in wages. For example, in India, wage structure in organized sectors is entirely different from that of the unorganized sector. 4.10.4 Minimum wages. Minimum wages in the lowest level of wages required for living a decent life. In 1984, the first minimum wages law was adopted by New Zealand. It was followed by similar regulations in Australia, Great Britain, US, Canada, South African, Europe, and Asian countries. Page 124. The Government of India has enacted the Minimum Wages Act in 1948. To fix minimum wages, minimum wage fixation boards are appointed by the governments. Such boards consider following factors while determining the minimum wages. 1. The preventing standard of living. 2. The cost of living. 3. The degree of inflation in the country. 4. The wages in other occupations, etc. Merits or importance of fixation of minimum wages. 1. From the point of view of social justice, it has been strongly justified. 2. Avoidance of industrial disputes. It maintains industrial and social peace. 3. Increase in efficiency of labor. 4. Increase in demand for consumer goods. 5. Redistribution of incomes from employers to laborers. 6. It induces the producer to increase production by the adoption of modern techniques. This results in the increase of national output. 7. Minimum wages law is a guarantee against exploitation. Demerits. 1. Minimum wages increase the prices, so inflation is the direct outcome. 2. Profits of the employers will fall due to the fixation of minimum wages. This will discourage the investments. 3. It treats all workers as equals, and workers with low efficiency also get the same wages obtained by a higher worker of higher efficiency. 4.11 Interest. Interest is the reward for the capital for its services as a factor of production. It is paid to capital for its productive services. Benham, the price paid for a loan. Caring Cross, the price paid for the hire of loan. 4.11.1 We now know that the meaning of interest. Before going into the theories of interest, let us know the meaning two important concepts of interest. 1. Net interest and 2. Gross interest. 1. Net interest. Net interest is the reward paid to the capitalist for the use of capital only. So, it is a payment made purely for the use of capital. 2. Gross interest. Gross interest includes more charges than that of net interest. It includes the payment for the loan of capital, payment to cover the risk of loss like A. personal risk, B. business risk, payment for inconvenience of the investment, and the payment of work and the worry involved in watching investment. Page 125. Theories of interest. 4.11.2 Classical theory of interest. Classical writers like Senior, Bohm, Bauwerk, Fischer, and others propounded the classical theory. Later on, it was modified and developed by various other economists like Professor Marshall, Wigan, and others. Classical theory is also called as the demand and supply theory because the rate of interest is determined by the equality between demand for and supply of capital. It is also called as savings and investment theory since the equilibrium between savings and investment determines the rate of interest. It is also called real theory of interest. Demand for capital. According to classical economics, demand for capital comes from their source. A. Demand for capital comes from entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs invest the capital in capital good industries, which helps the production of final consumer goods. Entrepreneurs demand capital because it is productive. It is subject to the law of diminishing marginal returns. Hence, The demand curve of capital slopes downwards from left to right. An entrepreneur will go on employing capital as long as the MRP of the capital is greater than the price of the capital, that is interest. The entrepreneur will be in equilibrium condition where the MRP of capital is equal to the interest. There is an inverse relationship between the interest rate and the demand for capital. Lower the level of interest rates, higher would be the demand for capital and vice versa. Supply of capital. Supply of capital comes from savings. The level of savings in a community depends upon a multiple factors. These factors are the level of income of the people, the living standards of the people, willingness to save, opportunity and facility to save, economic security, political stability, family affections, etc. There is a direct relationship between the interest rate and the supply of savings. Higher the interest rate, higher would be the supply of savings and vice versa. This relationship between the two is represented by a normal rising supply curve. Page 126. Determination of interest. This theory states that equilibrium interest rate is determined at that point where demand for capital is equal to the supply of capital or where investment is equal to savings. Below is a diagram, and in the diagram, S says savings or supply of capital curve, DD, investment or demand for capital curve, E, it indicates the equilibrium position, OI is indicates the equilibrium interest rate, and OM says capital demand and supplied. Criticisms. 1. According to Keynes, the equality between savings and investment is brought about by national income and not by changes in interest rate. 2. This theory assumes full employment, which is unrealistic. 3. This theory assumes the supply of funds comes only from the current savings. This need not be so. Past savings and hoarder savings may also add to the present supply of funds. It ignores the part played by bank moving in the determination of interest. 5. It neglects the monetary factors. It has given undue importance only to non-monetary factors like productivity of capital, etc. in determination of interest rate, but monetary factors like total supply of money, credit money, etc. are ignored. 4.11.3 Neoclassical Theory. Loanable Funds Theory of Interest. This theory is an extension of classical theory of interest. This theory was formulated by Swedish economist Wicksell. Later on, Robertson, Gunnar, Myrdal and others has defined it. The classical theory, while explaining the determination of interest, totally neglected the monetary factors and emphasized only on real factors. Page 127. But this theory integrates and synthesizes monetary and non-monetary aspects of interest like thrift, waiting, time preference, and productivity of capital, etc. According to the theory, the equilibrium interest rate is determined by the equality between demand and supply of loanable funds. Interest rate is the price paid for the use of these loanable funds. Loanable fund is having a wider scope. It is a comprehensive concept and includes not only savings out of the current income, but also bank credit, disholding and disinvestments. Likewise, the demand for loanable funds also is wider in its content. Capital is not only demanded for investment, but also for consumption and hoarding. Supply of loanable funds. The supply of loanable funds is derived from four sources. They are 1. Savings. Savings by individuals and household funds is derived from four sources. They are A. Planned or ex ante savings. Savings planned by individuals at the beginning of a period in the hope of expected income and anticipated consumption expenditure. And B. Unplanned or ex post savings. 2. Disinvestment. It is opposite of investment. It is said to take place when the stock of existing machines is allowed to wear out without being replaced or without providing for any depreciation a particular durable asset that will be wearing down. The fund which is set aside for replacements is called as amortization quota. These funds will become available for investments in the market by way of loanable funds. D. Disholding. Disholding of ideal cash balances, part savings, etc. may be released into the market. Resorting will be greater if interest rate is high. 4. Bank credit. As manufacturers of money, banks credit money and advance it to individuals and business units. Generally speaking, higher the interest rate, higher would be the advances. Generally, the supply curve of savings rises upwards from left to right. 1. Demand for loanable funds. The demand for loanable funds comes mainly from three sources. They are A. Demand for investment. Loanable funds are demanded for investment purposes. Investment may be undertaken either individuals, business houses, or companies. The investment demand depends on the productivity of capital. Page 128. It is interest elastic. It varies inversely with the interest rate. Lower the interest rate, higher would be the demand for loanable funds. B. Demand for consumption. People may borrow for consumption purposes. It arises when the expenditures are greater than the income of the people. This also varies inversely with interest rate. Lower the interest rate, higher would be the demand for loanable. 2. Demand for hoarding. Some people may like to hoard a part of their savings in cash. Hoarding implies keeping cash balances. This drive to hoard cash is called liquidity preference. The demand curve for loanable funds slopes downwards from left to right. Determination of interest rate is determined by a diagram which is given below. And in the diagram, the equilibrium interest rate is determined at the point E, where demand for loanable funds is equal to the supply of loanable funds. OM is equal to demand for and supply of loanable funds. OI is equal to equilibrium interest rate. Criticisms. 1. The theory emphasizes the importance of interest on savings. Page 129. 2. It is wrong to combine real factors like savings, thrift, investment with monetary factors like credit money, liquidity preference, etc., without explaining changes in the level of income. 3. Professor Hansen points out that this theory is also indeterminate. 4. The theory assumes that the supply of loanable funds can be increased by releasing cash balances of savings. This is not correct. Therefore, the total cash balances available with the community are fixed and equal to the total supply of money at any time. The change in the total supply of money is ignored. Whatever may be the criticisms, it is much more comprehensive than the classical theory of interest. 4.11.4. Liquidity preference theory of interest. Interest is a payment made for the use of money or capital. In his famous work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, J.M. Keynes has propounded the liquidity preference theory of interest. His views interest are as a purely monetary phenomenon because A. Interest is calculated in money. B. Interest is paid in the form of money. C. Interest is paid for parting with liquidity, that is cash money. And D. Interest is determined by demand for money and supply of money. Keynes defines interest as the reward paid for parting with liquidity, that is, giving up the cash balances held for a specific period, and interest is determined by the intersection of the demand for and supply of money. Demand for money. Of all assets such as money, securities, land, building, etc., the first one, namely money, is the most liquid, and money is demand for liquidity. The liquidity preferences schedule. The concept of liquidity preference implies the preference of the people to hold wealth in the form of liquid cash rather than in other non-liquid forms like bond, securities, gold, etc. People who surrender the liquidity are paid with reward, that is interest. According to Keynes, there are three main motives behind liquidity preferences. They are 1. Transaction motive. People hold money to carry out day-to-day transactions. In other words, liquidity have to carry some money with them always as they settle the transactions with money. It may be either in the form of cash or in the form of bank deposits. The liquidity demanded for transaction purposes depends upon the income of the people. Page 130. It is determined by A. The level of national income, B. Level of employment, and C. General price level. An increase in these variables raises the total volume of money needed for handling the transactions. On the contrary, transactions demand for liquidity will fall when the three variables decrease. 2. Precautionary motive for liquidity. People prefer liquidity in order to face the future uncertainties or unforeseen situations and emergencies. A portion of the income will be kept by the people as an insurance against risk and uncertainties of life like sickness, old age and business losses. This is the precautionary motive for holding money. The total amount of money required in the economy of precautionary purpose will depend upon the level of national income and the degree of uncertainty. Thus, the demand for money as a medium of exchange is motivated by transactionary and precautionary motives. Keynes regards both transactionary and precautionary motives as a function of income. So, M1 is equal to L1 in brackets Y. M1 is equal to L1 refers to cash balance required by people for transactions and precautionary motives. 3. Speculative motives. The money kept to get profits of the favorable situations in speculative market has speculative motive. According to Keynes, speculative motive is the desire of earning profit by knowing better than the market what the future will bring forth. The people who are engaged in speculation speculate about the future level of prices of all types of assets and securities. That is, a fall in the rate of interest, they would hold less money but more securities. If they anticipate a fall in the price of securities, that is, rise in the rate of interest, they would dispose of the speculators, and the anticipation regarding future are the main determinants of the speculative demand for money. The liquidity preference for speculative motive is a negative function of rate of interest. Less will be the speculative demand when the rate of interest is higher, other things remaining the same. More will be the speculative demand when rate of interest is lower. So, M2 is equal to L2 in brackets R. M is equal to L2 refers to cash balances demand for speculative motive. R refers to the rate of interest. So, speculative motive is a function of rate of interest. Page 131. Money demanded for all the three motives constitute the demand for money. M, a liquidity preference L. It depends on transactions and precautionary motives M1 or L1 and the speculative motive M2 or L2. M1 or L2 is a function of income Y, whereas M2 or L2 is a function of interest R. Thus, M is equal to M1 plus M2 is equal to L1 in brackets Y plus L2 in brackets R. Thus, in the liquidity function, however, it is postulated by Keynes that the demand for money is positively correlated with income, that is, an increase in the level of income implies a rise in demand for money and vice versa. On the other hand, the demand for money is negatively correlated with the rate of interest. The liquidity preferences schedule expresses the functional relation between the amount of money demanded for all liquidity motives and the rate of interest. So, diagrammatically, below is a diagram where LP is the liquidity preference or demand for money curve showing the inverse relationship between the rate of interest and the liquidity or amount of money demanded. As the rate of interest can never fall to zero or it cannot be negative, liquidity preference curve cannot touch O X axis. After a certain stage, when the rate of interest falls below a certain minimum, the demand for money increases because infinite than liquidity preference curve will be a horizontal line. This point is called liquidity trap. Supply of money. Supply of money is governed by the availability of money in the economy. Money supply is autonomously determined by the monetary authority. It is fixed and interest inelastic. Supply of money consists of common money, coins and currency notes, and bank deposits. According to Keynes, supply of money is a stock. Therefore, it's a fixed at a particular time and it is directly controlled by the state. Page 132. Here we have a diagram which shows the money supply curve is a vertical to OX as shown in the diagram. SS is a vertical money supply curve. We've got another diagram here which determines the rate of interest. Liquidity preferences is shown by LP curve. SS is the supply curve. Supply being fixed at rupees 2000 crores, the rate of interest will be 11%. In monetary authorities are increasing, the supply of money is rupees 400 crores, that is S1 supply curve. The rate of interest will decline to 10%. If the liquidity preference now increase to LP1, the rate of interest will increase to 12%. The people find it more profitable to hold cash balances at lower rate of interest than at a higher rate of interest. In other words, there is an inverse relationship for the rate of interest and the liquidity preference. Thus, the theory states that any change in the liquidity preference or change in money supply or changes in both respectively causes changes in the rate of interest. Given the money supply upward shift and LP rises the rate of interest, similarly assuming a given LP, when the money supply increases, the rate of interest also falls. Page 133. Criticisms. 1. Professor Hansen maintains that the Keynesian theory of interest, like the classical theory, is indeterminate. Liquidity preference cannot be known unless the income level is known. The rate of interest plays a very important role in the determination of income level. 2. In the opinion of Professor Hansen, the theory is one-sided, as it ignores real factors like savings, productivity, and time preference. Keynes referred to believe the influences of real factors by treating interest as a purely monetary phenomenon. 3. Keynes ignored the element of saving, which he considered interest a reward for parting with liquidity. Professor Jacob Wiener points out that the rate of interest is the return for saving without liquidity. 4.12. Profit. The profit is the reward for the services of the entrepreneur. Entrepreneur is a different factor of production than the other three factors. He undertakes the initiative of starting a business, organizing it, and employ other factors of production like land, labor, and capital. He bears the risk and takes all types of decisions regarding production. He pays rent to land, wages to labor, and interest to capital for the services in production. In return, he gets the production, he sells it in the market, and gets income from it. The excess income from the sale of production over cost of production is what is generally called profit. 4.12.1. Before getting to theories of profit, let us try to know the meaning of important concepts of profit, that is, gross profit and net profit. Gross profit. The excess of revenue earned over various payments and charges is regarded as gross profit earned by the firm. For example, a firm earns revenue of 15 lakh rupees from the sale of its production. It pays 10 lakh rupees to workers, capital in form of interest, rent to land, depreciation, charges, taxes, etc. In other words, its expenses and production are 10 lakh rupees. In such a situation, gross profit will be equal to 15 minus 10, that is equal to 5 lakh rupees. Net profit. Net profits are the profits which accrue to an entrepreneur for his functions as an entrepreneur. These functions include risk bearing, ability, innovating spirit, dealing with uncertainties, etc. Page 134. Theories of profit. 4.12.2. Uncertainty bearing theory of profit. This theory is given by Professor Knight. According to him, there is intense association between profit and uncertainty. He said that the main function of an entrepreneur is to bear the uncertainty. Professor Knight has divided risk into two parts in order to clearly differentiate between risk and uncertainty. Non-insurable or unpredictable risks. There are some risks which cannot be foreseen. These are changes in the customs, fashions, habits of people. Such risks cannot be insured or avoided. Professor Knight pointed out that profit is a reward for which unforeseen risk which cannot be insured or avoided. Professor Knight pointed out that the entrepreneur may have to bear uncertainties of the following kinds. 1. Uncertainty in the market conditions of the product from the consumer side. 2. Uncertain behavior of the competitors. 3. Uncertainty regarding technical changes in machines and equipments. 4. Uncertainties regarding trade cycles. 5. Uncertainty regarding intervention by the government. In this way, Knight emphasized uncertainty bearing as the main function of the entrepreneur for which he gets profits. Unless a certain return is expected, no entrepreneur will come forth to bear the uncertainty involved. Criticisms. Knight's theory has been widely discussed and criticized by many economists. The main shortcomings are 1. Uncertainty. Bearing is not a separate factor of production. The most fundamental criticism of the theory is that if we consider profit as an inducement to bear uncertainty, it implies that there is a connection between the level of profit and irksomeness of bearing's uncertainty, but no connection exists. 2. A narrow theory. This theory does not give place to concepts like coordination, decision-making, supervision. Profit-making involves all this, so the theory is a narrow one. Page 135. 3. Non-applicable to joint stock companies. The entrepreneurial functions are divided among shareholders, directors and managers of the company, but it is not clear in his theory. 4. Non-clear on role of expectations. The expectations of the entrepreneur play an important role in the choice of production. There are short-term and long-term expectations. Both these affect profits, but the theory does not give clear picture regarding this. Knight's theory wrongly assumes that profit is to be only due to uncertainties. There are many more things that contribute to profit. 4.12.3. Innovation theory of profit. The innovation theory of profit is given by Joseph Schumpeter. Here he attributes profits to the introduction of innovations in the production process or the sale of product. According to him, profits are the results of innovations. By innovations, Schumpeter meant all those changes in the production process which can reduce the cost of production. He pointed out that innovations can be of 5 types. A. Production of new or different kinds of goods. B. Adoption of new techniques of production. C. Discovery of new sources of raw material. D. Discovery of new markets for increasing the sale. And E. Changes in the organization of production. Schumpeter said that when innovations are introduced into production, the difference between price and cost goes on increasing. It is the cost of the origin of profits. Such profits are stable. They are temporary. They accrue to the entrepreneur for a short period only. After a certain time, when competition increases, the profits fall. Again, the entrepreneur introduces innovations and the difference between price and cost increases and profit starts coming to the entrepreneur. In this way, Schumpeter believed that profits are temporary. They result from the introduction of innovations by entrepreneurs. They wiped out due to imitation by the other entrepreneurs. Criticisms. Though the theory points out one of the very important functions of the entrepreneur that generates profits, it is not free from few criticisms. 1. Profits accrue not only due to innovations but due to many of the activities of the entrepreneur. 2. It has been criticized for its explanation of profit as being temporary in nature. Page 136. 3. Profits are neither temporary nor are wiped out after a short time. It remains for a long time. If the profits are wiped out so soon, no entrepreneur will stick to the production process. 4.13. Keywords. 1. Production. The term production means transformation of physical inputs into physical outputs. 2. Production function. It expresses the technological or engineering relationship between quantity of physical inputs and physical outputs of a firm. It is also called as input-output relation. 3. Total product, TP. Total number of units of output produced per unit of time by all factors input is referred to as total product. TP is equal to F in brackets QVF. TP is equal to total product. QVF is equal to quantity of variable factor. 4. Average product, AP. The average product refers to the total product per unit of a given variable factor. Thus, by dividing the total product by the number of variable factors employed. So, AP is equal to TP by QT or AP is equal to TP by QVF. 5. Marginal product, MP. It is the output derived from the employment of an additional unit or variable factor unit. So, TP is equal to total product, triangle is a change, QVF is equal to quantity of variable factors. 6. Isoquant. The term isoquant has been derived from iso, meaning equal, and quant, meaning quantity. 7. MRTS. The substitution of one input for another without changing the level of output is called as marginal rate of technical substitution. 8. Iso-cost curve. An iso-cost curve is a curve or line representing equal cost. It indicates the combines of the two inputs which the firm can purchase at given prices with a given outlay. 9. Producer's equilibrium. A producer or firm is said to be in equilibrium when it is able to produce more or highest output with the given outlay and given factors of inputs. Page 137. 10. Economics to scale. The advantages or benefits that accrue to a firm as a result of increase in its scale of production are called economics to scale. 11. Internal economics. Internal economics are those economics which arise within the firm because of the actions of an individual firm to minimize its cost. 12. External economics. External economics are those economics which accrue to the group of firms or the whole industry as a result of expansion in the output. 13. Transfer earnings. Transfer earnings is the minimum payment which is necessary to make a factor input to work in a particular occupation. 14. Quasi rent. Quasi rent is the period earnings of a factor input whose supply is fixed in the short run. 15. Wages. Wages are remuneration paid to the factor production labor for the services rendered by it in the process of production. 16. Interest. Interest is the reward for capital for its services as a factor of production. It is paid to capital for its productive services. 17. Profit. The profit is the reward for the services of the entrepreneur. 4.14 points to remember. 1. Production function gives the relationship between input and output. As the amount of one factor of production is increased, keeping others constant, the output goes on diminishing. 2. Producer will always try to reach equilibrium position, which can be studied with the help of isoquant and isocost curve. 3. Marginal rate of technical substitution shows how an entrepreneur tries to substitute one factor input for another without making any changes in the total output. 4. Factor pricing explains the payments made to factors of production for the services in the process of production. 5. The laborers try to raise the wage level through collective bargaining. 6. Rate of interest determines the demand and supply of capital. If the rate of interest is high, demand for capital will be low and vice versa. 7. The reward that entrepreneur gets for his service in production is the profit. Page 138. 4.15 References. 1. Modern Economic Theory by K.K. Dewart. 2. Modern Economic Theory by H.L. Ahuja. 3. Principles of Economics by M. Mellon Jingan. 4. Principle of Economics by K.P.M. Sundaram. 5. Economic Theory, Ramani Nair and Iravati. 4.16. Check Your Progress. 1. Explain the Law of Variable Proportion, 4.4.1. 2. Critically Evaluate the Producer's Equilibrium with Isocost and Isoquant, Curve, 4.5.1. 3. Bring out the advantages and disadvantages of internal and external economic to scale, 4.7.1 and 4.7.2. 4. Analyze the demand and supply theory of rent, 4.9.1. 5. Explain Keynesian's liquidity preference theory of interest, 4.11.4. 6. Discuss the uncertainty bearing and innovation theories of profit, 4.12.2 and 4.12.3.